Welcome to VMN Volume 5, Episode 2. The date is May 22nd, 2026. VMN is produced and transmitted from unceded Abenaki territory of so-called Vermont. Today I will be talking with June Goodband, who is standing for governor in the so-called state of Vermont, which is occupying Endokino. Welcome, June. Good to see you.
Hello, Marina.
Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and why you want to stand for governor? First, who are you?
Okay, well, that's a hard one to answer. I'm just a person, and I've been a counselor, a therapist, and mental and drug and alcohol counselor in various roles for around 40 years, and I've seen the way the current systems. All sorts of systems, particularly economic and social service systems, create and sustain suffering for a lot of people. And I think this could be done very differently. And I think that we need to make drastic changes in these times and really move to a system where people are taking care of each other and we move away from the strong centralized government as a way of counteracting what's happening at the federal level.
So,
anyway, so that's where I am.
So where is the system failing and how does it harm people? Can you elucidate a little bit?
Well, first off, it fails by its structure. It's structured to keep some people poor and other people get richer and richer. It's structured to concentrate wealth and power at the top and to disenfranchise large groups of people. And it's always pushed for uniformity and conformity and exclusion of anyone that doesn't fit in the box that they've created. But now it's overt at the federal level. They don't want diversity, they don't want difference. And the rich differences in who people are and how they work and how their brains work is one of the greatest resources of society. The differences in cultures. You know, obviously, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture has not brought us great fruits. And we should not rely on that to be the central thing that we live from. So how has it harmed people? Okay, I can run examples. Okay.
Yes.
I've gotten an example. They all over the place. There are old ones and there are recent ones. One where someone couldn't figure out the homestead tax forms. They'd been really sick and they weren't functioning and they were at risk of losing their house because of tax sale. Turned out people in their community didn't especially like them, people in government in their community. And so they were proceeding as rapidly as possible to put their house up for tax sale. And they'd made an effort. They'd paid a third of their taxes, but they were late with the next part, so they added that much back on for fees. And then there's no help. Okay, I made a mistake. I can't figure out the paperwork. And they were calling to ask for help, and it's like, well, you know, you'll have to deal with it because we don't have any funds for that kind of thing. This person was at high risk of becoming homeless. That would cost the state a lot more, and it would have cost that person immense suffering. And we have no space for homelessness in our society now. So that's another way it fails people, that if you do become homeless, there's not only almost no path to getting housed well in any short-term way, but secondly, you're not supposed to sleep in public areas or private areas, which means, I guess you're not supposed to sleep.
Where did this happen? This government trying to force someone out like that? I mean, I know it happens everywhere, but I always like to nail things down and have things not be abstract. Where did it happen? Which town was this? Which town was doing this?
I don't want to give that because of client confidentiality in small towns. I will say I know of two cases where that happened, one in the Northeast Kingdom and one in Windham County, Southern Vermont. I'm sure there are cases all over the state. Actually, I know another one where they condemned a house and then sold it to someone who was a friend of the select board. And because she had to get out, it's condemned, you can't live there. And she couldn't pay her taxes because she had to pay rent. And so they took the house and then they sold it, and a friend of the select board fixed it up and sold it for a lot more money.
I've always been, in the last 10 years, I've been pushing for people to actually take direct action against, to prevent evictions. Like when people, a town tries to take someone's house, we have to try to have community members show up to block that. It's nice to talk about structural stuff. What structural stuff takes forever. What are your thoughts about actually having 100 people come up to a house like they've done in Portland, the Red House defense, and say, "Hell no, you're not t putting my neighbor on the street." How do you feel about that?
I feel like we need everything. We need the short-term immediate responses, and we also need real structural change. And as long as we have a government which we pay to control and attack us, it's going to control and attack us. And if instead we can get that system to actually work for people and not just for a few people, but for everybody. That's and so when I say for everybody, I mean right now people are treated like they're disposable. As long as they're contributing to the economy, they are valued enough to be allowed to live. Sort of. If they're contributing to the economy at certain levels, they're barely allowed to live. But if they're not contributing sufficiently to the economy, nobody cares. The government doesn't care. The people are taught to turn away because, you know, we can't support everybody, take care of everybody out of our own pockets. We have to have some collective system of care. And that's been, and we've been taught that we don't. We've been told, you know, oh, the charities will take care of that. That means people with extra wealth can decide if they want to help someone live or not. Why do we have people with excess wealth?
So what do you in New England, you had the town meetings. Do you feel that those might be a vehicle for making things better, or do you think that they're just a vehicle for excluding people, you know, if you're not WASP enough to participate? Because I may be wrong. I think the town meetings are happening less and less and less and less often. What's your feeling about that?
I think town meetings are happening less often, or they're getting structured differently, because it's not an actual holiday, so people don't get time off work to be able to participate. And therefore, everyone prefers Australian ballot because then they can at least participate. They can go before or after work and do it. But an Australian ballot stops us from having actual discussions and meeting people face to face and connecting. And I think it can be a vehicle to empower people, and it can also be a vehicle to exclude people. And seeming different in a small town can be actually dangerous. I mean, I'm not worried about it because I, for myself, because there are so many ways that I seem normal. That having different ideas, they can think I'm a crackpot, but they don't necessarily think I'm like from the wrong culture or I'm going to just say too different to consider.
What are your feelings about collectives of mutual aid? Actually, instead of going through government, you create these networks of mutual aid that actually take the the function of government, so it puts more power in people's hands. What are your feelings on that?
I think it's wonderful. I love it. The only problem I have with it is that so many people are not going to be included. And they're not going to be included partly because they can't imagine it. They don't know how to connect to it. It's not part of their way of understanding how things work. So I would like to see something that affects everybody generally, not just the people that are, not just the radical fringe. Okay, I love the radical fringe. But I also know that a lot of people aren't going to fit in that radical fringe and are going to be just excluded from that too.
During COVID, I remember there was mutual aid between people, at least where I live, the neighbors were looking out for each other to an extent. It seems like that's broken a bit. From personal experience, I've noticed that the mutual aid, the leftist mutual aid stuff has been exclusive to people who don't belong to a certain aesthetic and a certain way of relating. They don't seem to, they get blocked or thought of as crackpots. Can you talk about that and a little bit about how the culture works in that? Because that's not something I quite understand.
I'm not sure if I understand it either. I understand that in our society, we're stratified in a lot of ways. So, one way that we're stratified is by social class, one way is by I'm going to call it world outlook. And it's really a pretty small minority of people who are not wealthy, who think that they're not wealthy because of the way the system works. Most people who are not wealthy think they just don't have it. They might not say, I'm not smart enough, or I'm too lazy, or but it's sort of like, I just don't got it. And that attitude makes it very hard to believe that anything can be different. It's just the way it is. And so we end up with leftists and politics separate from the rest of the world, which is not what we want, because what I mean when I say leftist is I want to include everybody. I want everybody to be valued. I want every person to be treated as if their lives matter and they're worthy not only of living, but having a chance to have meaning and joy in their lives. So I don't want to exclude people that get dismissed as trailer park trash or rednecks or people with limited IQs or people who are ill or disabled. But oftentimes they exclude themselves because they don't feel like they belong in this group of people who have different beliefs than they do.
One thing I've noticed, because there's a veneer of social conservatism around here in Vermont, especially in the poorer people, you'll find that. But if you scratch a little bit, you say, the government, the town doesn't care about us. They say, yeah, it's just the rich people who are got everything in control, and these idiots over in the local town, and they'll agree with you. And if you scratch that way, but I mean, there is this downtrodden, yeah, I'm this social structure is justified. That's what they say, because that's a survival skill. Yes, sir, to the cop, instead of saying, get the fuck out of my driveway, which happened the other day. They were blocking my driveway. it seems like if you look for it, there is that spark. But if you just maybe as a therapist, you're talking to people who are much more downtrodden than I do. I mean, I talk to even conservatives, some of my neighbors are, they say I'm a conservative, but then they, say healthcare should be free. What is this? Why are they doing this to us? And they don't like the cops. But they, when you, if you just talk to them on an everyday level, you're going to hear, I accept this. And then, but if you scratch a little bit, that resentment of the system will come forth. Maybe you're talking to different people than me, or maybe you're talking in a different way.
No, I saw it. It's sort of interesting because I was a candidate for governor before, and there were a couple people on my caseload that I pretty much knew were going to vote for Trump. Or one I thought was, the other one I wasn't sure. But I told them what I stood for in my platform for governor. And they said, "Yeah, I'm with that. I'm with that. Get rid of prisons. Yeah." They were on every single one. And then they said, "But I'm voting for Trump. I'll vote for you, but I'll vote for Trump." And it's like, what? Do they not understand that these are completely different ways of thinking about how the world should be and governance, and that I'm talking about building power from the bottom up? And he's talking about taking power from the top and stealing it from everybody else. They just didn't.
I mean, I think there's a certain, I'm an abolitionist. I want to get rid of cops. I want to get rid of prisons. But there's, when you're an abolitionist, you have to start looking at yourself. Where do you want to punish people? Where do you want to, make people suffer? Because abolitionism is deeper than get rid of the prisons. It's you don't become the same monster that they're showing you. I mean, I struggle with that myself. I mean, I don't know that I wouldn't be as monstrous to a torturer as they've been in their life, maybe more, because I want to get rid of them. But you have to confront that. And there's a deep sadism in political conservatism. It's punish the person that is wrong. I mean, there is a person that you and I both have dealt with who is an abolitionist on a very deep level, and they've confronted that in me and in other people. You can't be wanting to punish, because that's carceral thinking. Can you, especially as your background as a therapist, maybe you can give me more about this sadism, this want to control, this want to punish difference? I mean, maybe you've got an understanding more than a special understanding from your profession on that.
I don't know. I think the only way my profession gives me understanding of it is that once I really talk to people and understand where they're coming from, what things mean to them, it is generally easy to like them. And not necessarily to agree with them, but to know why they think what they think and how they feel. And, what you're talking about, from my point of view, has to do with undoing the training about all we have to do is attack, the domination picture, that we create a society by, we create a more just society by controlling everybody. And to take away control and replace that with compassion and understanding and connection is to move away from more. It's not conflict. I don't mind conflict, but an aggressive domination system towards active peace. So active peace means I actually see you. I want to hear what you feel, what things mean to you. And a lot of people are conditioned to not even know what they feel and to not be able to say it. But many people could if we gave them the opportunity. And to be able to talk deeply about our understandings and our feelings is really, and listen deeply to each other is how we can get past that attack. I don't know what I would do if I was forced into a situation where I had to do something violent or destructive. So I can't judge someone else for doing that. Now, we might say they weren't forced into it, but they may have experienced it as this is the only option I have, which is a sense of force. You know, a prison guard, I lived in near Newport, and I live in Springfield now. I don't know any prison guards here, but I've met prison guards up there. And a prison guard gets to be a prison guard because it's a decent paying job for somebody with a high school education. It's got benefits. It's got what looks good to somebody who doesn't feel like they can stand working in the factory another day or who can't get a job in the factory. But there are downsides to it that they haven't really thought about.
Yeah, I think jobs like that corrupt people on a deep level, and you become their one of our former neighbors is moved out of state, and their husband is considering a prison guard job, and I've been like telling them this is he's going to become abusive because prison teaches you that you have a right and actually responsibility to control others, and you've seen this. This family has a former prison guard in it who became controlling and abusive of his wife after he became a guard. And now that he's lost his job out of because he got in a traffic accident, he's actually becoming more violent because of that. I mean, I think I'm gonna show my cards a little bit as when it comes to therapeutic approaches. I'm very interested in people like Erich Fromm or Wilhelm Reich. Exclude the woo-woo stuff from Reich, but I think that the field of therapy needs to be expanded in a way that we look at. I'm not the problem. The structure, the web of society is what needs healing. We have to figure out how to approach this problem because work, like Reich says, the rigid German society created fascists, the horrible parenting, the abusive stuff. And how do we undo this? And it's a multi-generational thing, because you have generational trauma, you have things that are taught through generations. Can you wrap your head around this a little bit?
Yeah, actually, my preferred therapeutic teachers are Michael White. Actually, there are a lot of other narrative therapists who are brilliant, but the founders were Michael White and David Epstein. And one of the key phrases is the person isn't the problem is the problem. And that they really look deeply at power within systems, including within the therapeutic system, but also within the wider structural system, and how that affects people. And not only power that's overt power, but that covert power that takes over our minds. I've got the quote. I know who said it, but I can't. Steven Biko said, I might have this quite slightly wrong, but the most powerful tool of governments is the mind of the oppressors is the mind of the oppressed. And that they really work to get in our heads. And we don't even know they're doing it. It's from the beginning. That's just the way it is. Deal with it. It's unfair, unjust, so what? Deal with it. That's what you get. Or, well, if you work hard, everything's going to be okay. You're not working hard enough, it's your fault. All of these messages that we get kind of combine in our minds to create acceptance and tolerance of a system that is inherently destructive and actually get us to be co-creators in that system. So in narrative therapy, we work to understand the narrative, understand where it comes from, find where people have resisted oppression in their lives, because usually they think of that as being bad. Like, oh, I was a really bad kid. I was always causing trouble. I wouldn't put up with this. I wouldn't do that. It's like, when did you develop that ability to resist? Where did that come from? And sometimes we'll just say, it's just how I've always been. And you change the frame from you were a bad boy or a bad girl to you were resisting oppression from the beginning. And it may not have worked out well because every time you resist, you get squashed down, but you still didn't give up. And what does that say about you? And what could you do to resist more effectively instead of like stop resisting, which is what the messages that you get all the time. And maybe even ask, what would happen if you did stop resisting? How would you feel about yourself? How would you feel? What would that be like? So you're asking questions, and people kind of go into like, oh, if I just accepted it and went along with it, what would happen? And they feel what that would be, and they usually don't want that.
I worry about kids that don't get in trouble. I mean, if people will have conversations with their kids when they get in trouble. If I had kids, I would be, the kid is you're in middle school. You've never gotten in trouble. There's got to be something you've got to chafe against. What is going on? And that's I've. That, there's an anarchist parent I know, and we had that discussion a while back. She's a nurse, and I adore her, and she raises kids, but they all get in trouble. They're like her. I mean, to give you an idea of her, one time we were in New Hampshire at a party, and she just brought out a slingshot and was like shooting stuff in the town. So this is like a full grown woman, and she's like that feral. So the example is get in trouble. So yeah, definitely. I mean, it's
I
I
think it's important to recognize that there are lots of different ways to resist, though. That some people resist with a slingshot, and some people resist with finding a way around it, working under the radar. Some people resist just by surviving. And you'd be surprised. I'm sometimes surprised at the things people survive, and that they come through and they stay alive and they stay. Empowered.
I grew up in South Jersey, and I was literally hunted by people. I would go out driving somewhere, and they'd see me in a car, and they would chase me. I've been chased into woods. I've been chased into cornfields. The people that scared me most were the Atlantic City skinheads. It's a very violent Nazi gang, and they were just a little bit older than me. Some were my age, and there's perhaps one of them left. They are all dead from ODs or going to prison or just bad living. There's a Jewish thing, a saying, we will outlive them. Motherfucker, you're dead. You're in the you sh schön und dreht. Great. I outlived you. I lived in fear of running into you on the street. You're in the ground. Great. Yeah, maybe that's a little partial thinking, but I didn't put them in the ground. They did it themselves through bad living.
And they didn't entirely do it to themselves. When we go back to this thing about not wanting to punish people, they were indoctrinated. And maybe they chose who indoctrinated them. It may have been their parents, but it might not have been. But they were seeking out belonging and connection. And I had this odd idea when you said this. It's like, oh, that's how you turned out the way you did. That you had the good fortune of being chased by actual Nazis, whereas I thought Nazis were in Germany in the past when I was a kid. And that the places I got oppression from were school systems, family. And I didn't, and being just discounted. And so there are all different forms of oppression and attack. And I'm not sure which are the most damaging and malignant. Sometimes systems that are supposed to support us and help us actually become the most oppressive.
Yeah, because you accept them and you think they're there and then they get into you. How does all this fit into the system? Because the people I run with say this is the colonialism infecting one's mind, white supremacy and patriarchy. How does that all tie together? I mean, I see it as sort of a thread that gathers all of this because it colonizes our way of thinking. It isn't just external, it's the internal fight, it's the true jihad, fight against internal battle. Can you talk a little bit on that?
I could, but I'm not sure where to start the thread there. Especially because I feel like where I am is moving from the internal jihad to trying to actually change the systems. Because we have systemic patriarchy, systemic racism, systemic militarism. And I don't just mean militarism like doing stupid things like attacking Iran or Venezuela or I can't even fathom this, Cuba. These are extreme, terrible militarism, but there's also militarism of the police force and a militaristic mentality that we can fix things with force, that force is going to solve things. And now I'm risky getting into religion because I really strongly believe in the power of, I'm going to call it the power of divine love, transformative power, and that we need to work with that. Now, am I making it up? I mean, a lot of other people believe in it, but I think that if we're acting from anything else, we aren't going to create systems that work. If we're acting just from anger and resistance, it's not enough. We need to transform power and make it something where we're working together, supporting each other. And if we can't challenge that basic assumption that the way we can live is by competition, by taking from each other, then we aren't going to survive as a species. And we might not anyway because it's a little late, but I want to still work on it.
I mean, there was a very distressing psychological experiment. I think it was 57. It's called the Stanford Experiment, where the kids in a college were set in a fake prison situation, and the structure of the institution created the sadism we see in prisons. That's an example of a structure creating the behavior. How can we have a system here of politics that creates sadism? It creates taking away. How can you say this can be transformed, or do you think it cannot?
I think that we need to subversively use all the tools and resources available to us. And that one tool is the state of Vermont. It's a system that we all, well, most of us pay into, and they have funds. and they also have institutional power. And that if we can take charge of that and use it to create systems that actually help people. I mean, and I shouldn't throw stones here because I think that the health and human services system, economic services, the nonprofits that are used, they do help people. But they don't help people in a way that draws support and resources from everyone and gives everyone what they actually need. It doesn't help people in a way that builds thriving communities. It's a charity system, which is different than we're working together in a mutual aid system. So we can create a system of health and human services that looks more like mutual aid and use those resources. So what I picture is a community care center instead of economic services and NECA or SEFCA or whatever organization is supposed to give help, where someone can walk in and meet with a person and talk about what problems they're facing, what resources and skills they bring both to that problem and also to the community. So we're seeing a whole person. We're not seeing, oh, this is a person with a problem. And then we don't fit them into a box and say, well, you're eligible for this program and this program, so you should go there and there and there and apply for those. We instead, or this is the paperwork for that. We instead help people come up with creative solutions and help them fund the creative solution that's needed. Looking both at the short term, I can't pay for heat this month and it's February. And long term, how can we increase your income, decrease your costs, create a system situation that's actually supportive for you in your life? And that you'd walk in, oh, you also can walk in and say, hey, I want to volunteer for something. Oh, fill out this form about the skills and your interests and what you might like to volunteer for. And then people coming in looking for volunteers have that. Hey, I need a job. I need to hire somebody. Look, I've got this contract to build a house and I, or to renovate a house. I don't have enough help. I walk in and they can look at the bank of the list of people there. So we include economic services, volunteer services. And when I say resources, I'm not talking just about money. I'm not talking primarily about money. A lot of people with no money have skills that a lot of people with money don't have.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of economic services and those things, I think, yeah, I've seen the good side of them just get helping people get stuff. But what actually in my life is more overshadowing is, I have friends who have had to flee the state because they're poor, and DCFS was saying they're going to take their kids because of their defective housing system, and they're loving parents and everything's fine, and it's just, they insist on a standard of living that is not even common in, much of the world, and try to impose that on that. I mean, it's this is the parts that I really, the carcerality of economic services, and they're actually recruiting old prison guards to go into DCFS, and it's like, I wonder how that something, a system that's that corrupt, can actually be reformed. It's just staggering how, it's like you have you had in the up through the 1950s and 60s, people's children being stolen, well, up into the 80s, Indigenous children being stolen by various schools. And then people don't realize that DCFS is still stealing children, and it is primarily vulnerable people they're stealing their kids from. Can you talk to that at all?
First off, the outcomes. When kids are put in foster care, especially long-term foster care, are usually poor. I'm not saying that it never works for anybody. Sometimes it saves a life. Sometimes there's a child that's being horrifically abused and gets to a safer place and does better. But often, the statistical outcomes for children that age out in foster care are really poor. They don't have very much chance in life. And so we should be really thinking carefully about this. And what flashed in my mind is, yeah, Abraham Lincoln would have been pulled out of his home because they had a one-room cabin. Whoa. What did the parents not have sex? What happened there? They didn't have what we, they didn't have running water. They didn't have electricity. They didn't have, I realized that those weren't things that were expected at the time, but that we expect people to have things that were not usually available and that people can't afford now. And, we're talking about a housing problem. People aren't allowed to have an outhouse now. And I've been puzzling about that because I don't see where a septic system actually does more to protect the groundwater than an outhouse that's placed conscientiously does. Or, and certainly not better than a composting toilet does. So I don't understand why we can't just allow people to have less expensive systems that work.
Yeah, and I just going back to like DCF, my impression of seeing this, there's horrifically abusive parents that have resources that never get looked at by that system.
I
It's
agree.
marginalized people who get looked at by the system, whether honestly, whether they're poor or not,
I've
it's
seen real abuses in DCF. I saw one system where a woman left her husband because of serious physical abuse. The physical abuse was documented by the state. The police took pictures of her with her bruised face and talked to her, talked to him, had documentation of what had happened. And after she left, the father wanted custody of their child. And he lived, came from a family with money. And they hired a lawyer and they figured out a way that he got custody of the child. It happened through DCF taking the child for. She claims that this didn't even happen. A friend of their family reported that it happened, and then her child was taken away. There was no evidence that it happened. Like they looked, was there any bruising? Was there anything wrong? No evidence. And in most cases that I've seen, DCF would have looked at this and said, okay, she. If she had done it, she was a little rough with her child. She might need some parenting support. But instead, they instantly took the child. This wasn't sexual abuse. It wasn't gross physical abuse. It was a moment, reportedly, a moment when she was slightly rough with a 2-year-old. I think most parents are slightly rough with a 2-year-old sometimes. 2-year-olds throw fits, throw tantrums, resist. And they are not logical, rational human beings. They are feral, as you say. So that's just how it is. And the state supported the father getting the child back by dragging it out for years and having the child placed with the father's family so he had more contact. And I've also seen other situations where they take a child children when the parent is trying to be protective but lives in a poor neighborhood or is trying to be helpful to a neighbor who turns out had drugs with them. I've just seen outrageous things happen. And if you live in a freestanding house, not an apartment, so no one's there to report on you. If you have resources to challenge it in court, you are much less likely to have problems with DCF. A lot of abuses get pushed under the rug. And in the past, it was even more extreme because I had someone who was sexually abused in her family have everyone around her tell her, well, it's his fa it's your father, he can do what he wants. This was someone older than me, so it was Vermont in the early 50s, late 40s. And there were no expectations about how parents should treat their children at that point.
Well, that's some pretty dark stuff, but what would you do? Would you retain such an institution as DCF, or would you get rid of it and just have a decent community support? I mean, I'm given my little dealings with them. It seems like in a lot of ways that's a institution that needs to go, you know.
I don't know about immediate abolition. I think starting with finding ways to support and help families, things have gotten a lot worse for families. You know, when I was a child, most families had a parent that was home. If the kid was sick, somebody was there to pick them up from school. If they got home after school, there was someone there with them. Now, it wasn't always a good person. They weren't always kind and supportive. They didn't always know what to do. But in a lot of families, there was at least a sense that somebody was there. And now, whether it's a single family household or a two family household, people are very, very busy. And even kids are kept very busy, like with structured activities all the time. In poor households, that's not always true because there are fees to participate in things, or because the parents just can't get them to the games they're supposed to go to if they live a distance out in the country. But this highly structured lives and little time for just hanging around and being together, this creates problems for people. We've had generations now of children who really weren't parented because their parents were so stressed and so stretched for both time and money. And that's sad. Of course, we had bad parenting before that too. It's not like we've always had great parenting and everything's been wonderful, but the economic stress of expecting everyone to work a lot of hours in order to get by is a big problem. And if we got rid of that, a lot of things would be better.
I mean, one thing I see with raising kids is this is less so out in the countryside, but in many, I would assume this is true in Vermont towns where there's eyes on people. Kid out unsupervised running around is abuse in a lot of America. I don't know if that's everywhere in Vermont, but people get their kids taken away for letting them play in the yard. Like, you know, I ran wild. I was all over the place. Yeah, I could be miles away when I was a kid and, you know, get back for dinner in time and no one cares. And if you're a little late, where were you? Oh, it took me a little longer to walk back. I got stuck in the mud in the swamp, you know. You know, it's like, but I mean, I kids nowadays, you get in trouble for simply drawing in your notebook in a way that is frightening to people. The police get called because you say, I want to get rid of the school. You know what I mean? And I remember in school writing essays about that for English class. And nowadays the kids get police get called. Can you talk to what has happened to society?
I think it's one of those ironic things where we have taken away the opportunities for as much care and connection as kids need, and we've added opportunities for control and coercion. And structuring everything, you know, it's not the same to be I have nothing against sports, by the way. I think it's fine to play on the baseball team, to play soccer, to whatever you do. But to not have free time to just go out and play, to engage in fantasy play, to find, play in the woods alone or find your neighbors or, have somebody come over or, I live in in Springfield, Vermont, and I have someone who I'm quite close to who grew up here and is grew up here in the late 40s, early 50s, or late 40s and 50s, and would just go out and play. And he had neighbors. And it was restricted somewhat in which ones he was allowed to play with, which ones he wasn't. Crazy family. But that he would just go play. Play in the woods, play, sled down the hills, play in the sand, play in the dirt. And he could go all over town, starting when he was like six. Before that, he had to be in the yard. But he could be with another kid in the yard. And the amount of freedom kids had then was much greater than most kids have now. I'm kind of lucky my grandchildren had a lot of freedom because of where they lived and who their parents were. Oops, I can't hear you.
I'm going to jump tracks really quickly. Forgive the abruptness of the change of topic. There's a lot of anti-war activism going on now. I believe you participate in anti-war vigils. I'd like to talk about those and about a specific problem that I've been running into. I'm of Jewish background. I'm an anti-fascist, anti-Zionist Jew, and I've taken serious losses in my life for supporting Palestinian rights. I was actually kicked out of a school for almost 2 years while I sued to get back because I supported Palestinian rights during the first Intifada. I find myself nowadays being attacked as being too soft on Jewish people and for speaking out against anti-Semitism. Against in some of these movements. Can you talk? I mean, it's bizarre to me because I'm probably could not go to Israel because of my previous opposition to that occupying government. Can you talk a little bit about that? About this, what's going on?
We have people and we have ideas. And there are people of various cultures who share the idea of a shared humanity and of, I think in Jewish tradition it's tikkun olam. Is that the right? Doing what's best for everyone?
Tikkun olam is repair of the world.
Yes, and
Olam
I've
is world. Tikkun is repair.
I think that that's really pervasive in a lot of cultures that we have a part of us as humans that want to repair and fix things. We want to make things better. We want to heal. And there's a drive towards healing. And there are ideas about the chosen people or the best people or that we have rights because God gave us this, or we have rights because we're the biggest assholes around. Whatever. Those
Absolutely.
ideas are really dominating and horrific. And they aren't the province of Jewish people or even Anglo-Saxon people of Anglo-Saxon descent. They're in the water here. We get them every place around us. We're taught that from our earliest stage. Obey authority. Somebody has rights over you, has rights over everyone, and want to be the biggest dog because the biggest dog is gonna win. And that there's I mean, in the US, it was the manifest destiny idea. In Israel, it's I don't know what the phrase is, but it has to do with their right to have the whole territory and to obliterate anyone that stands in their path. That is not about being Jewish. It's not about a religion. The religion doesn't really support that, as far as I can see. It's about believing in domination and colonization. And we get it from every side, like we don't even question it, because otherwise we would have to question ourselves all the time. And people don't like to do that. It's too uncomfortable. So I'm really sorry that you're in that bind of you're soft on Jews. Like, you're soft on humans, although not always. Sometimes you're pretty nasty about some humans. But you're soft on humans, you're hard on ideologies that are destructive. Whether they're religious ideologies, political ideologies, ideologies in systems that are destructive.
I have a friend, I don't, I'm not shy to talk, say his name here, Daryl Lamont Jenkins. Daryl is famous for helping Nazis leave movements. He always has an open door to talk to anyone. Even if they're abusive to him, he will listen to them. And, you know, as an anti-fascist, I'm a thug. I will go after people. I've fought Nazis, and I said, you know, I told Daryl, you know, I'd like to be more like you and talk to these folks and try to get them out, which I do. I'm actually good at, but I can be very combative at times. And he said, no, Marina. I'm gonna have to edit out my name, but it takes softening them up to get them to talk to me. So do what you're gonna do. I mean, I make people lose jobs and get kicked out of places, and I have, and it's a lot of them don't even know it was me. But you know, it was two sides of it, and one of Daryl's best friends was once a well, his roommate once was a leader in the National Alliance. She was their spokesperson, and she still has white power tattoos, but she will fight. She has literally fought other Nazis, or she's former, to protect Daryl. And you know, I think there's a process, and sometimes, you know, when people see that their behavior is causing consequences, sometimes that's part of the whole solution. Maybe I'm wrong, but you know, I prefer to be. When I do a lot of community defense, I prefer to talk to people, but if and de-escalate them with voice, but if they insist on attacking, well, I'm gonna have to do something.
Right. And I think what's critical is to respect that there are all different approaches. And all of those different approaches are needed. And part of it's based on we're all different people. And we have different skill bases, different knowledge bases, different ways our brains are wired. And it's when we talk about neurodivergent, I'm not sure how wide the neuronormal band really is. I think that most people don't really fit the normal, but have learned ways around it and seem like they do. We need to work for more strengths and we need to work together. And there are all different approaches. And I'm not going to judge somebody else's approach because I think my approach is better. Because I don't know what's going to work. We just have to do everything we can.
Well, we're coming up. We're a little more than an hour in our talk. Is there more stuff you would like to bring forth before we wrap up?
Well, I'd like to have another podcast at another time and talk more about this idea of how we could use reorganizing the governmental system of quote service delivery to further the goals of local cooperation, local building power at the local level. Because my big thing is I want to see us redistribute power. I'd love to see us redistribute wealth, but I think in order to do that, we have to redistribute power. Right now, we have something like an aristocracy that controls all the power and the wealth. And I'm not happy with it. I want us, I want all the people, and not just us like the enlightened left, but us like all the humans to have power.
I think it's important when we talk about wealth and power. It's like when you get past a certain level of wealth, it doesn't mean anything. It has to be converted into power because it's meaningless to have $1 trillion. You look at someone like Musk, he's trying to create control, and I think that's important to for people to understand is money and wealth don't really separate because your capital has to be spent somewhere if you're going to be expanding your wealth.
Right. I think I learned this at an early age about wealth and power. And not that early, I was a young child, but I remember my father talking about it, and he had a cynical view and became more capitalist. But he had experiences that brought him up against, wait a second, we don't have the freedom we think we have.
So if there's no more else to say, I will read us out and we can talk again at a later point.
Okay,
If
wonderful.
you like this podcast, please consider sharing and liking it on your social media. Reviews help drive the algorithms that basically run the internet world. So please, if you have time, leave a review on your podcast aggregator. Reviews on Apple and Google help a lot. So if you're willing to deal with those companies, and only if you are willing to deal with those companies, leave reviews. Otherwise, tell your friends about this podcast. This was VMN Volume 5, Episode 2. VMN was formerly known as Vermont Movement News and can be found on podcast apps as Vermont Movement News. Thank you very much, June. Thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.